good evening and welcome on in this night after. The night after Halloween. I've got my co-host here, David. Boy, that microphone's hot. Can you tell that?
Yeah, that's hot, all right.
It sounds like I turned on a vacuum cleaner here. Just started pulling all the dust out of the room and bringing it into the console. This is QSO Live, and I really appreciate you folks tuning in tonight. We've got a lot planned, but we have a real fun show tonight because we've got a real fun guest, a gentleman that, let me just say this. Let me give him this kind of an introduction. He was asking me how big of a delay we had between here and the transmitter and out on the air, and I was trying to think. We got one stream going in one direction, one going in another direction.
These things are going all over the place.
And probably about a minute, I would think. At least a minute.
Yeah.
So we're probably not technically on the air right this second as I'm speaking.
Right, yeah.
But we will be a minute from now, anyhow. Isn't that confusing enough? One thing that our guest tonight has done, and that he has made a career out of promoting our fraternity called Ham Radio. He's been involved in the promotion of this fraternity, and he has, I guess I want to say, given a chunk of his life to it.
Yes, he has.
Through several endeavors. He's a regular on Ham Nation, and he also has his own Ham College podcast. I'm trying to grab onto what I should call it. It's a podcast that airs that they record, which is Ham College. It covers all kinds of subjects, and if you're trying to get into the hobby, this is something that really and truly, excuse me, can help you. And and also he does the smoke and solder thing. I don't know if there's something he hasn't done. I can't think of all the things, but I want to say welcome on in to W5JDX. George Thomas, how are you?
Good evening, Ted. Good to be here with y'all tonight. Yeah, I've done a lot of things, maybe unintentionally on a good bit of it, but hey, it's out there now.
Well, you know, I remember the early days of smoke and solder, you know, and it kind of struck me at that point, kind of strange that, well, you know, here we've got television cameras, you know, trained on a circuit board or whatever you're working on, and people can actually see what you're talking about. So when you talk about how to desolder something or how to solder something in or how to use a pair of needle nose pliers to heat sink a part or something, you know, you were demonstrating these things where people could actually see it. Otherwise, you know, they would have to have a personal Elmer that would show them how to do this. And of course, personal Elmers today are in short supply, I guess is the best way to put it.
Yeah, you know, it all started out, I guess, with amateur logic. Of course, I've worked in radio and television. I got my first job in radio in 72. And I worked on the air back then because that's all a 16-year-old could really do. But I moved on into engineering, and I spent a few years in television too. But about 11 years ago, when we were first, I guess, you know, getting broadband internet spread across the country pretty good, and the computers were finally fast enough and the gear was cheap enough that you could produce your own videos and upload them to the internet and people could watch them. Well, I talked to a couple of friends of mine and I said, hey, you know, I'm always tinkering with something or, you know, doing things like that. And I know there's other folks out there doing it like you two. What do y'all think about maybe trying to put a show together? I'd seen a video podcast, some of the very early ones. There weren't many around in those days. Leo Laporte had not even started doing video yet. He was just beginning to do Twit as an audio podcast. And we threw a couple of them out there and called them Amateur Logic. And some people watched them. And we said, well, this seems like fun. Let's do some more. So that's kind of how I got started in all of this. We used the name Amateur Logic, but that really didn't necessarily mean ham radio. It was myself, Tommy Martin, N5ZNO, and Jim Burrell, N5SPE, and we weren't really set out to do a ham radio podcast. We were just going to do like an experimenters and technology type of podcast, and I happen to do electronics, but we all just happen to be hams. And the name Amateur Logic came about because Jim had a website, or he had registered a name for a website called Concocted Logic. And I like that name, but he didn't want to use it for this. So I said, well, what about amateur logic? You know, and it just means not professional logic. So that's originally what amateur logic meant. Of course, as we started doing it, we found out more and more that our audience was a large percentage of ham radio operators. And those who were watching that weren't hams were starting to get interested in the hobby, and a lot of them got licensed. So that just kind of led us in that direction. And it's been a lot of fun, little work, but, you know, I really didn't start out to train a lot of amateur radio operators. We were just sharing some fun things that we were doing. And, you know, all of this has just been kind of a bonus that we were able to Elmer some folks and make some new hams along the way.
You know, it's amazing. You know, with QSO, we concentrate primarily on the human side of the hobby and talk about people and what they've done and what they're doing and, you know, what kind of mischief are they getting into. And I try to find the politically incorrect to put on the air, you know. Because, you know, I'm a troublemaker. But anyhow, I think, you know, this is a completely new dimension, I guess what I'm saying. And that is, now YouTube is, it's just crazy. I mean, if you want to know how to take the transmission out of your car or how to fix your Vitamix, you know, or how to make your own hand cleaner cream or something, you just go up to YouTube and there's somebody up there somewhere is going to show you how to do it, you know. And, you know, for ham radio, I think, you know, this kind of a weird thing. The world has gotten strange. In other words, I think there used to be more Elmers available to actually do hands-on. I remember guys having, like, little gatherings in their home, you know, where newbies would come along and they could see somebody solder and desolder something and how they'd learn all these little techniques, but they learned it firsthand. Well, it seems like those guys that were doing that kind of dwindled. I mean, it seems like they just kind of went out of sight. And, you know, I don't think there's not very many instructional videos on ham radio that you could buy. I don't even think the league puts out anything like that. So now all of a sudden comes this video stuff that you're doing, and this gives the opportunity for just the average guy that doesn't know anything at all about a soldering iron or anything at all about transistors or MOSFETs or, you know, whatever the latest solid-state devices are, you know, AND gates, NOR gates, you know, he doesn't know anything about that. And here you come along and with a video picture can actually, the person can sit in his home or on his smartphone, mm-hmm. wherever he is, and click on that and watch these videos and gain understanding that, gosh, I don't know, where else would you get it? I guess you'd have to enroll in a technical school, and I don't even know technical schools even teach the staple parts of it.
No, I don't think so either.
Yeah, you know, I don't think they teach that. So you got a corner on the market now, you know.
Well, me and a lot of other guys, you know, maybe we were among the first to do it, but there's all kinds of people out there doing this now and, you know, sharing tips and showing how to build things and showing techniques. I learned a lot myself by watching some of them. And you mentioned YouTube. Well, when we started this 11 years ago, and it was, I guess, 11 years last month is when we put out our first episode. YouTube was brand new. Nobody knew what it was. I got an email invitation from them to join and, you know, upload some videos there. And we did, but YouTube was nothing. This is before Google had bought them, before really anybody had heard of them. And there was maybe a couple other services that were out there doing that at the same time. But somehow YouTube got the foothold and took off. But when we first started, you know, the bandwidth was not that great. We were running BitTorrent servers at each of our homes, and that's initially how we sent out our videos, is you would have to have a BitTorrent client to download it.
Do you go back as far as dial-up and running Trumpet Winsock? And do you remember Trumpet Winsock?
I don't remember Trumpet, but I go back as far as dial-up modems and transferring files over packet radio. Back when long-distance charges were real high, I had a friend that lived in the next long-distance zone from me. We fooled around, and, of course, packet radio was good for doing text and stuff, but really there was nobody transferring files on it. We ran across a YAP terminal program that you could transfer files on, and we were both experimental computer programmers. We sent a lot of data back and forth over packet radio that otherwise we wouldn't have done, because the long distance charges would have been too high. But so I've been doing that really before we had a public internet. And
It was the BBSs, you know. You dial into a local BBS, and some of them they charged, you know, and some of them with Trumpet Winsock, you could get internet access through them. And but they had, like, for example, the free ones, you'd log in, and they'd have a whole slew of files you could download, all kinds of things, you know, programs of all sorts. And the thing was, is you had to upload X number in order to be able to keep your equilibrium. You couldn't download more than you were uploading. And I thought about that. I thought, well, how are you supposed to come up with these things? You know, you just, you know, you go to BBS to BBS to BBS and you find something that you didn't have. And, you know, but that was fun. I remember that. I remember. And oh my gosh, can you imagine now what it would be like to be stuck on dial up and on a local BBS, and
ouch.
And we yell and scream now when YouTube buffers for a second or two. You know, it's like, what's wrong with this thing? Why is it not working? Anyways, and I don't know. There's been a lot of technology changes. When you take a look at what Leo Laporte's doing with video now compared to, you know, what went on back in those days. You know, but then here we are. I mean, you guys were pioneers. You know, you were at the very, very beginning stages of this thing, so you've been able to see, you know, all these changes take place. Well, you know, let's do this, because I know you're a radio engineer, and have been a radio engineer for a while. I guess I'd like to start at the very, kind of like at the beginning, and say, okay, where did you get bit by this bug? Where were you first exposed to this electronics phenomena called amateur radio? And did anything precede it? Were you like either a shortwave listener or a crystal radio addict or something? Or what caused this this fetish to occur in your life?
Well, all of the above. For some reason, when I was a kid, I was just kind of drawn to electronics. For some reason, it just fascinated me, and so did radio and audio. And I lived in a small town. It was a small college town. There was a junior college there, and when college wasn't in session, I think the population of the town was like 500, and there was only one other guy in town that I knew that cared anything about this electronics hobby, and we would get together and talk about things some. And then later I met another guy that really wasn't into electronics. He was just a genius and just happened to know something about it. And so I'd talk with him about it. But, you know, there goes a repeater now. I'll turn that off. Anyway, we just, I didn't have hardly anybody I could talk with about electronics, just, you know, two or three guys. And I subscribe to Popular Electronics Magazine, and I used to read that. And from that, I learned about ham radio and about shortwave. And my grandfather had a shortwave receiver. Well, it was actually an AM/FM radio that had shortwave on it, too. And when we'd go to their house, I would play with that radio, and I'd hear all these weird buzzing sounds and things and foreign languages. And it was just real fascinating to listen to that. And, you know, I didn't know what the data was. I mean, I was hearing data, I'm sure, and probably jamming too. But it was just all these signals that were on there. And none of my friends or anybody knew anything about any of that. You know, they were all AM radio listeners. This was, you know, during the 60s and early 70s. So, they weren't even listening to FM yet.
Ladies and gentlemen, you're listening to QSO. We'll be right back with our guest, George Thomas, right after this. Here's a great idea from hamtestonline.com. If you've already got your ticket and you know someone you'd like to get into the fraternity of ham radio, this is the time to do it with a special program called Ham It Forward. You can pick up a membership. They're about $25 for the technician test. And I'm telling you, I know folks that couldn't put batteries in a flashlight that wound up getting their ticket through Ham Test Online. Ham It Forward. That's the name of the program. Get other folks involved in this fraternity of ham radio. You will be so glad you did. It takes all the work out of being an Elmer and gives you the confidence, as well as the person taking the test, that they know the material and it's easy, it's not boring. HamTestOnline.com for Ham It Forward. HamTestOnline.com. If you're looking to purchase a new piece of ham gear, think no further than R&L Electronics. That's R&L Electronics. You can find them in Google. You can locate their website. And you need to go there. These are folks you can trust. These are folks that you will enjoy purchasing a piece of equipment from. And not only are they honest, but they will give you the best possible price. Prices that you won't find at any other ham radio distributor. That's why I go there. And I love the friendly folks. Let me tell you, if you're thinking about antennas, transmission line, microphones, amplifiers, antenna tuners, HTs, whatever you've got on your mind, do not hesitate. Do not hold back. Call R&L Electronics. Google them on the web. You can find them real easy. That's R&L Electronics. Okay, right now, I'm sitting next to a stack of QSL cards and a stack of U.S. postage stamps. That's right. You want one of these QSL cards? Do ya? Well, then get off your butt and send us an email. The email address is simple. It's simply email at WTWW.us. That's email at WTWW.us. And we will send you a QSL card. You'll have your own WTWW official QSL card. Hey, once again, folks, thanks so much for listening to WTWW, your favorite shortwave radio station just outside Nashville, Tennessee. I want to tell you about something that's just absolutely, simply amazing. And you say, what's that? Well, it's the MFJ 939 automatic antenna tuner. And you ask, what's so amazing about it? Well, it's very small, compact unit. It'll handle up to 200 watts. I mean, it'll handle a Drake TR-4, a Swan 350, or any modern radio that's out there. You simply plug the output into the 939 antenna tuner, give it about 5 to 10 watts, and it just tunes. No cable. You don't have to have a cable running between the tuner and the radio. It's utterly fantastic. Very quiet. You will love this thing, and it's priced unbelievably low. You need to go to the website, mfjenterprises.com, and check out the 939 antenna tuner, or just Google MFJ 939. Now, some think that the ARRL is a bunch of old guys with square glasses and powdered wigs in Newington, Connecticut, looking down their noses at the ham radio fraternity. It's just not so. The ARRL is all the thousands of people you see at the Dayton Hamvention and Flea Market, the smiling faces at Hamcation, the happy people at Pacificon, Huntsville, HamQuest, Shelbyville, Dalton, and many, many more. All the hams that listen to the QSO radio show, and the thousands of hams that listen to WTWW, that's the ARRL. All the folks that are listening and watching Ham Nation. Hams in Washington, D.C., representing you and all the hams to the FCC, protecting our rights as members of this fraternity. And right now, you can be a part of the ARRL for $49.95. That's right, you get 12 issues of QST, a major technical magazine. Very professional magazine. What? 12 issues for $49.95? But not only do you get that, you get every issue of QST ever published online. You get representation in Washington. And you know what? They offer a consulting service. Got a problem with your radio or your antenna or your installation? You can call Newington, Connecticut and get an expert on the telephone to help you talk you through your problems. 1 year membership to the ARRL for $49.95 is the best possible deal you could ever hope to find in terms of ham radio. Go to their website, ARRL.org. That's ARRL.org, and join today.
But I kind of liked electronics, and I read about ham radio, but I didn't know any hams. There were none where I lived. And so I really didn't know how to get into it. I did eventually buy an ARRL handbook. I don't remember what year it was. And I looked through it, and I saw these projects and things, and they looked like a lot of fun. But I still didn't know any hams. Well, fast forward a few years, and I was a teenager. I was 16. I got interested in broadcasting, and I had seen some newspaper, well, not newspaper, probably it was in Popular Electronics, an ad for, you know, get this book and get your third-class radio telephone permit, and you can have a high-paying job in radio. So, you know.
I'm sorry.
Yeah.
But so, I remember. But let me ask you a question. When you were doing, when you were reading Popular Electronics and listening to shortwave, did you ever get one of those WPE numbers? The Popular Electronics would issue these. They were like call signs.
No, I didn't. I should have. I got some little kits, you know, that you could build. Some of the P-Box kits from Radio Shack. And I built a little, a couple of different, you know, wireless transmitters. One, I think, had a crystal microphone on it. Another one was maybe a little step up from that. And I could broadcast around the house with those. But I built a couple of crystal sets, probably at least three or four of them. And I was never successful with any of them. I live too far away from a radio station to pick up anything. And but that didn't, you know, keep me from being interested. So, 72, I knew about this, that you had to have an FCC license to work in radio. And one day at high school, a friend of mine, it was in the same class I was with. We weren't really friends. We were just in the same class. But I noticed on his stack of books, he had a third class radio telephone operator's permit study guide. And I started talking with him, and he said, yeah, there's a, you know, there, the radio station in Kosciuszko, a small town is about 30 miles away from me. They've, you know, they got a couple of openings over there, and, you know, here's who you need to talk to. So that's kind of how I got into to broadcast radio is I went and took my test, passed the license. It got a part-time job working evenings there. But the owner of that station was a ham at K5VAK, Mims Boswell. And, you know, I still didn't know a lot about ham radio, but another guy that was a couple of years younger than me got a job there at the station, too. He was only 14, so his mother had to drive him to work and drop him off. But he was a general and had been a general for a few years. I don't know how old he was when he got licensed. He has not been active in a lot of years now, but he got – I talked to him about, you know, how did I get into this ham radio thing? And he says, well, you know, you just got to study. You got to, you know, take your theory and test. And, you know, that didn't seem too bad to me. I knew I could study all that stuff, and I'd kind of been studying some electronics already, and I could learn the rules. But you got to take a Morse code exam, too. And he said, I've got this Smith code course record, and I'll let you use it. So he brought me the album that had the Morse code practice stuff on it, but he never could find the book that went with it. So I didn't get my ham ticket then. I was a late bloomer. I did not get into amateur radio until 1991. Of course, I realize now that I've been in it long enough to join Quarter Century Wireless, but it doesn't seem like it. You know, it seems like I've only been doing this a few years.
Well, you know, I was going to say, though, there's something that clicks in your head somehow that causes you to seek this stuff out. I mean, I run into people all over the place, and I ask questions. What? How did you get started in this? And invariably, it may be an uncle, or it could be a grandparent. It could have been the guy next door. It could have been a buddy in school. But even with all of those variables, there's still something that clicks inside of you that draws you to it. Or you wouldn't notice it. It would just be like, you know, I mean, how many people in your family had other things they did, like either played the piano or, you know, hobbied with something else, stamp collecting, you know, or something like that, you know. But something, I don't know what it is. I think maybe we should say it's the radioactive element, you know, that comes to life inside of an individual that causes them to want to go in this direction. And I think it goes even further with some people, where they're not satisfied just to get in it. They're instigators. They got to get other people involved in it, you know. So, I mean, I see you as one of those instigators. And there's a few of them around. Bob Heil's one of them. You know, Bob Heil, he wants everybody to get into amateur radio.
Oh, yeah. And I call it more of an affliction, you know.
That's a good word.
And, you know, it's whenever I'd get in trouble when I was small and my friends had done something, I was right there with them doing it. She would say, well, and I'm sure we've all heard this before, you know, well, if everybody else was going to jump in a lake, would you? Well, yeah, probably.
And my grandmother used to say, now, if old so-and-so over there poked his head in the fire, would you do it too? You know, it runs along the same line, I think.
Yeah, so with the ham radio thing, you know, I enjoy doing it. So, you know, hey, I want as many people to do it as can. I don't understand why they wouldn't. Oh, by the way, our friend Mike Morneau, the E3MIC up in Canada there, just sent me a text here on Skype and said that we are 5'9 And I've forgotten what city in Barrie, Ontario, I believe, is where he lives.
I don't know where Barrie is.
S9 plus 30 with a little QSB.
Well, that's cool. You know, we've had this solar activity we've had, though. We have had the strangest signal reports come in. The fellow, John Gorski's out in Idaho, and he'd write in and say, I think it's Idaho. I'm trying to think. I always confuse. We got so much email, I can't keep track of where everybody's at. But anyways, we'd be normally, pretty good, real good signal. And then since this solar flare stuff started coming along, he's written me a couple and said, oh, now you're down to S5 tonight. Say we got to get a bigger amplifier. Got to do something here.
Yeah. I've noticed that here too, Ted. Normally I've got a very strong signal here on WTWW, and you began carrying us on Ham Nation carrying Ham Nation on here a few weeks ago. And at the beginning of Ham Nation, usually at 8 o'clock, I can tune in and I've got a super strong signal on it. But before 9 o'clock gets there and the show's over, it sometimes it's faded out completely on me. I'm really too close.
Well, you probably are, but we're getting email from places like boats out in the middle of the Indian Ocean.
Wow,
we're almost full scale on their S meters. It's like you just don't know. It's strange when you sit here and you're behind the mic, and of course now you're sitting there. It's the same thing with you. You just don't know where the signal is going. You don't know who is listening. We had a gentleman write an email. I'm on, just doing my normal thing, playing some oldies and some country in the evenings, trying to make shortwave radio listening interesting and giving folks a reason to crank the HF rig up and listen to it across the room while they're busy doing something else, And this email comes in, and this guy says, I'm listening to you. And it's me and my dog, and we are on a boat in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean. I left Scotland, and I think he'd kind of fallen on some depressing times in his life, so he bought a boat and jumped in this boat with his dog and took off. And every night he was listening. Now, he could email me through this email device, but he had no internet access per se. All he had was internet or email. He could send and receive email, but he didn't have web access. And I don't know how that works, but it's kind of cool that he had at least email. So he's out, and I got to thinking, who's listening to this signal? And I have no idea where they are. Couldn't even dream of it if I had to. And he listened all the way into wherever he wound up, and I think he wound up south somewhere near the West Indies is where he actually, docked the boat and settled down. But he traveled all the way from Scotland and all the way. Now, the amazing thing was the shortwave radio he was listening on was like a little $10 shortwave. And I don't guess it worked all that well. He strung some wire around on the sailboat and basically listened every night. And one of the things he wrote that I read, he said that, he had to knock it off at night sailing because he'd get sleepy and tired. But after he discovered WTWW... And we're playing B-Bumble and the Stingers and the Supremes and things like that. Then he was able to sail well into 2 o'clock in the morning, because we were keeping him awake, So that was kind of, I think we're going to get together. I think he's coming on the show and we'll have a chance to meet Christopher. But, boy, what a story. So, it's like you just don't know. You don't know who's listening. But you know what? The same applies to ham radio. You're sitting there talking to some friend. You don't have any clue as to who else is listening and where they may be. You just don't know.
That's just true.
Part of the magic of radio. But I was going to ask about what do you think at this point? Okay, I know you have a passion to see other folks get into the hobby. You have a passion for folks to learn things that they wouldn't normally be able to learn unless you guys were producing your podcast, your video podcast. But I guess I'm gonna ask this question: what do you see in the way of if we want the hobby to thrive and survive, even though we may be bringing numbers to the table? What do you think it's going to take to keep those numbers? In other words, what is the fraternity of ham radio? What is its biggest enemy, do you think? What causes people to turn away or get, you know, hang up the equipment?
People. That's the biggest obstacle in ham radio, I think. I think we've got to engage the new people that are coming in. I think that's our biggest downfall right there, is we get comfortable talking with the friends that we usually talk with, and somebody new comes along. And now a lot of groups will welcome you right in and elbow you along and make you feel like part of the team, but others will ignore you, and you know, some will even tell you to go away, and that's not the ham radio way. And not everybody's that way. There's just a few groups that, you know, will kind of give somebody a bad taste for amateur radio. By and large, most hams are real friendly. But I think when the new hams get in here, we've got to engage them, you know, talk with them on the air, spend a little time with them on the repeater or wherever they are. You know, if we hear somebody new ID on a repeater, talk to them, you know, make them feel welcome and, you know, make a new friend there. And I think that's very important. And I believe that's where we fall short so much. Of course, you know, we like to help people now. You know, if somebody needs an antenna or something, well, you know, we'll go help them string it up or, you know, solder a PL259 for them or show them how to do it and things like that. That's all part of it. But, you know, when they get their license, then what? You know, that's the next step. That we got them interested enough to take the exam, to get licensed. Now, you know, let's help them develop that interest and find out just how fun the hobby can be. You know, it's one thing I try to promote is you see me doing these things, building this little project or, you know, building this antenna or testing this piece of gear. If I can do this stuff, y'all can too. It's not that hard. You know, that's what I try to promote. It's you see somebody that you think is really smart, and really all they need to do to appear really smart is to know just a little bit more than you do. And then, you know, you learn that next level, and it just kind of, before you know it, you've learned more than you realized that you had. And that's kind of my enjoyment of all my hobbies: ham radio, electronics, computers, programming, music. You know, it's just to keep adding a little bit to the knowledge, and kind of keeps it fresh. And you know, that's my thing. I think we got to engage folks. We got to show them, okay, welcome to the club. I hear some fun things you can do.
Well, you know, I guess the thing that crosses my mind is I think a little bit about 2 meters. Because people that get their technician tickets, I remember back a long time ago, back when you'd get a technician license, you know, the guys were still operating CW down on the HF bands, but they wanted that technician license because it gave them phone privileges on 2 meters, you know. So with a lot of the new hams around and with a lot of these little Beifung radios and all the stuff that you can get for almost nothing, I would think that our 2 meter repeaters would just be jammed, but they're not.
No. And that's a shame.
I don't understand it. I really don't. I mean, now, but I do to some degree. And what I mean by that is we have had what I want to call the ham radio Gestapo.
Yep.
That raises their head in almost every city, and they are the rent-a-cops or the would-be policeman, but below the level of security guard that appears on the air to enforce their opinion and their whatever. You know, and I've run into my share of them. And I can see where they would drive people away or at least scare people. You know, somebody gets a ticket and they get on and they're a technician and they want to get on the local repeater. And they run into one of those Gestapo guys, and they get scared. It's like, ooh, I can't talk on here. I don't have the experience, and, you know, I haven't been around long enough. And, you know, they begin to think all these things. And pretty soon, if the conversation is not entertaining on the repeater, and I do mean entertaining, if there are not some colorful characters on the air carrying on and talking and making conversation, people are going to get bored and just shut them off. That's it. You know, I'm not going to waste my time on this. We had a guy on, it was during Field Day Live, and I believe he was from Dallas. I can't remember now.
Yeah, it was down in Texas.
And he said that they have massive amount of nets on their repeater, and they love those nets because it keeps everybody talking. And when the repeater goes dead for a period of time, there's an automatic announcement that comes on and basically says, this repeater has been inactive too long. Will somebody please start a net? You know, I said, I love that. I think that's great, you know. But I could see the people, some of the people here that I deal with in the Nashville area.
Well, what? There's too many people talking on a repeater. Right? We got to keep this thing clear in case there's an emergency.
You know, and that's, you know, that's really their whole thing. They're sitting around waiting for the sky to fall, you know, and it's like,
get out of my way. Sky might fall here 10, 15 minutes. You never know what's going to happen, you know.
So you see that, and I think it puts everybody an arm's length away from the fraternity to start with. They say, well, I'm not welcome here, and, you know, I'm not Chicken Little, and I'm not expecting the sky to fall. I mean, things like running hams off of a repeater, blind guys. They're at the school here in Nashville that one guy ran him off the repeater on a sunshiny day. You know, you don't want to be on here because the weather service monitors this and they don't want to hear your jaws running, you know. So it's like, you know, come on, let's just get real. The sun is out, and today when there's nothing going on, weather service can turn their machine off if they want to. They can turn their 2-meter radio off if they really turn it down or something. We see some clouds in the sky and a few bolts of lightning. Sure. You know, then everybody lay low in case we got to start a weather net, you know. But there's too much of that. And I think that's also, I've given this a lot of thought. I think that is also what has caused the rash of bad language and QRM on 80 meters. And the reason why I say that, I think we have had so many curmudgeons belly aching and moaning and groaning about all kinds of things where you can't hardly enjoy the hobby, and I think it's antagonized the crazy people. And I think that, of course, to get on the air and use that kind of language, you got to be crazy anyways. But I think there's such a thing as antagonizing a crazy person, you know, and if you do that, then you're going to get crazy, you know, out on the airwaves. So I don't know. It just seems like if everybody had better manners, and they also had in their heart to welcome new people in and make conversation with them, including the new people into the group or into the circle, you know, you never know who you might meet. You never know what that person, who they are, what they may be engaged in, you know. They could be bringing a whole new group of interest into the circle that you're part of. But I think we've got a little problem here. I think I think all of us in ham radio, we need to seriously think about how do we fix 2 meters? How do we get people back on talking? How do we make it a fun, happening place to be? I don't know.
Yeah.
Correct me if I'm wrong.
No, I echo pretty much all of that, Ted. You know, I got licensed, like I said, in 91. Let me go ahead and confess right now. I am a no-code extra. I never learned the Morse code. I got my technician exam in 91. The first weekend after they changed the rules so that you did not have to take a code test, to get a technician's exam. My friend Jim Burrell, who I mentioned earlier that we started Amateur Logic together, he called me one Thursday night. I was working now, you know, in broadcasting here, and I was chief engineer for, the biggest stations in the state. And so I had some radio experience under my belt, and he called me on a Thursday night, said, they've just dropped the Morse code requirement for a technician exam. I'm going to be coming to town Saturday. I've got the study cards here. He had the flashcards from VIS. And you can go over them, and we're going to go take the test Sunday morning. And I said, okay. So he brought the cards. I went through them once, because that's all the time I had to go through them. And then we went and took the test Sunday morning and passed and bought our first radios. And I was a technician for a lot of years until, a few years ago when they dropped the Morse code requirement for all classes of licenses. And then, I studied the first exam spot I came open. I had studied for general. I went and took my exam and passed the general. And while I was there, they said, well, you want to take the extra? And I said, sure. And I took it. And there were a lot of red marks on my paper because I had not studied for the extra, but I passed it. So I went from technician to extra in one sitting. But, I don't claim to really be smart. I'd just been around the stuff a lot, and I'd studied for one FCC exam. So the other one, the questions kind of made sense, because those exams, if you you do enough of them, you kind of see patterns in how they ask questions. And if you're going to exclude me because I don't know Morse code, I do. There's some things I do know, but if you don't be part of your group, then that's fine. But otherwise, I'm probably qualified to be talking with whoever. But when I got my technician's license in '91, when that rule first changed, the repeater police around here were exactly like you said, and they were club members. Club on most of the repeaters, and it was exactly like what you're saying. They pretty much would run the technicians off of the club repeaters. Didn't want them talking there. All except me. They treated me okay because they knew I worked in radio, and I knew, other people in radio and television and knew electronics. So they welcomed me in, but they didn't welcome in my peers, the other technicians.
Well, they were probably intimidated over the fact that you worked on transmitters bigger than they'd ever seen.
Well, yeah, probably so, but I didn't like that because, I had all these other guys that we got our licenses at the same time, and they had just as much right to be there talking as I did. So I've never joined a club. It put a bad taste in my mouth. Since then, most of those guys have died off. And that continues to happen. So, we've got, people coming in and leaving the hobby. And eventually most of the, like you say, repeater Gestapo will be gone. But they're making new ones to replace themselves. And we don't need that.
Well, I ran into one gentleman here in the Nashville area. I was driving along, and some guy came in and signed his call sign. This guy came back and said, there's a weather net in progress here, and you're not supposed to be transmitting unless you've got weather traffic. He just jumped all over this guy like he was a criminal, murderer, And I thought, what is that all about? Well, I sat and listened a little while. Now, this guy didn't say a word. 15 minutes went by. Not one word out of his mouth. He never once said, this is, K5, K3, XXX or whatever, and there's a weather net in progress here on this repeater, and, the National Weather Service has issued something. Nothing. Absolutely nothing. Just dead air. And about 15 minutes later, another station came in. This guy was in Kentucky, and he signed his call sign, and here comes the guy. You know, and I thought, what in the heck? I wrote him a letter, and I gave him Hail Columbia. I said, people like you, first off, you don't deserve the license, let alone the ability to insult other amateurs. You know, I said, you don't conduct a net properly. How in the world? So he wrote me back, and he said he was from Detroit, Michigan. I said, well, I'm sorry, I'm from Detroit too, but I don't know anybody from Detroit that treats people the way you do on ham radio, you know? And, you know, so he thought that was some sort of a justification. Well, that's the way we run nets up there. And I said, BS. There ain't nobody I know up there that's on ham radio that's rude. You really need to get the Rude Award, you know? So, you know, and I kind of think maybe that is what the intention was with the grandfather of ham radio, Hiram Percy Maxim, when he came up with the Ready Snitch, you know, and the Wolf Hong, was to kind of help bring a little reality and lower the self-importance of some of those fellows that feel like they've got the right to just run over the top of some folks. And new people are intimidated by it, you know, and that's, I think that's where the tragedy is. If there was some way we could teach new people, you know, to bite back, you know, we'd be a lot better off, you know. I don't know.
Well, you know, it's such a shame, because here you've got somebody just got their license, they've spent their money, they bought their radio, they're sitting there, and they're waiting to push that button for the first time and talk, and they've got mic fright, and then something like that happens, and, you know, it's just not right. But I don't want to give all the listeners the impression that all hams are bad actors like that. No, there's a lot of really nice folks out there, too. On some of the repeaters, and on HF, I tell anybody that's, you know, just got their general or extra or whatever, listen around a little bit before you start talking on HF and find where it is and who you want to talk to, but more importantly, who you don't want to talk to. Because, you know, there are some groups out there that are exactly like you're saying, use foul language and holding conversations. It really, there's no reason for them to be talking. There's just, you know, they're just spreading hate or something. But there's also really good groups of people out there. And one that I want to mention, and I'm not a member of them or affiliated with them in any way, I will occasionally check into their net late in the evenings. But I think it's one of the friendliest groups around on 80 meters. It's the the Freewheelers on 3916 kilohertz. If you're just getting into HF, listen to 3916. They run a net there, and it's pretty structured. They take check-ins. You give them your call sign. They'll put you on a list, and when it comes around to your turn, they'll call you, and you can speak, and you can talk about whatever you want to. It can be short. It's just your name, you know, where you are, maybe what the weather's been like or what you've been working on. It's just a real casual group, and they're just sharing the frequency one at a time. Everybody's real friendly, and to me, that is a perfect group to get started with on HF, because you're not going to be run over there. You're going to feel welcome, and you don't have to know a lot of technical stuff. You know, you can just come in and talk about anything you want to, and it doesn't have to be very long, and you can get over that mic fright. You know, it just seems like a great place to, you know, for a new HF operator to get started.
You know, what I was going to say is one of the reasons why I feel it's important to tackle this subject, because you're one of these guys. You're like Bob Heil, and you're like Gordon West. You're like a ham radio evangelist, you know, and you're putting a lot of effort into this. So the point being is you really don't want someone coming along and sabotaging the effort. You know, you really don't. I mean, I don't want someone coming along and sabotaging the effort that way. But so by addressing this, we're letting the newbies know. Yes, we do have ill-mannered people. We're saying ignore them. For everyone, yep. Every one of them that shows their butt over the radio, there's another 50 to 100 that will treat you really good. The other thing is you got to keep in mind a lot of hams are basically socially challenged. So just because they're not overly friendly doesn't mean that you're being rejected or anything. They just, a lot of guys just, they really just don't know how to come across. So it's a combination of things. But the thing that does is, you know, it's like all you have to have to really not have a good time is one bad tooth in your mouth. You know, just one bad tooth that wrecks the whole day, you know. So, yeah, but matter of fact, you were talking about the freewheelers. There's a fellow I've talked to a number of times. It's in the middle of that pretty good, and that's a fellow by the name of Pete Thompson. I don't even know Pete. But
I knew that's who you were going to say. Somehow I knew.
Tailgaters and freewheelers. And, you know, they do all kinds of stuff on there. They'll have oldies trivia questions, and, oh, gosh, they throw everything under the sun out there. And they keep it going. I mean, they keep it really interesting. There's all sorts of subject material they bring up, and they've got certain times that they do certain things, you know. And I have them on all the time listening to them, and I really and Pete's a character. I mean he's the ringtail leader of all that trouble on 3916. I'll tell you what. And but see this is what makes it fun is things like that. And the reason why I wanted to cover this subject with you especially, because I know that you have a heart for our fraternity of ham radio, and you I'm sure you're just like I am. It kind of upsets you. But how do you get the word out? How do you say, hey, listen, if you get on HF and you run into a rascal, or you get on 2 meters and run into a rascal, how do you forewarn people and say, look, just ignore them guys and keep going? Because that's what we had to do. And you know, they're out there, you're going to run into them. And but I think that, like, right now the thing that really gets to me is I wonder, the question keeps popping up in my head, especially after a fellow like Bob Greenberg comes along. I don't know if you know Bob, but he's the one that's developed this app for the cell phones that and the ARRL, I think, has adapted that app as their official repeater directory thing. I don't know, but you put it on your cell phone and it'll, you know, you drive through an area, you can find every repeater there is in just a matter of seconds with the frequency, the PL tones, and somehow, if you got the software and you got the smarts, George, you can get it connected up to your radio somehow. Bob tells me all about all this stuff, and I'm like, well, yeah, okay. But it's really ingenious. And with him coming up with that, I really applaud it, because between that and Echolink and IRLP, it's just there's no excuse for our 2 meter repeaters being so dead. You know, I think we need to, everybody make an effort to get on, you know, turn the car radio off and turn on the ham radio, you know. And I don't know.
And when you hear somebody new on there, say hello, you know, give them somebody to talk to. They just went and bought that new handy talkie, and if they go ID on all the repeaters and nobody comes back, they'll eventually get tired of it, and you don't want that, you know. We're going to lose these frequencies if we don't bring new people in and get them in the habit of using them.
You know, one of the things I was going to have you talk about is that you get on your podcast, and usually there's, you know, somebody else for you to play off of. But talk a little bit about conversationalism, or whatever we want to call it. The art of making conversation with people. You know, and the most difficult thing is to sit in a room by yourself with a microphone. And they tell you, you're doing the morning show. You know, who do you talk to? You know, but when you introduce another person and you're on ham radio, why don't you talk a little bit about that? Because I know you're into the, I know you're real apt at the technical end, but I also think you also have talents in this area too. And I think it would be good for you to talk about it a little bit.
Well, that's another one of those unintentional things, I guess, Ted. It's just kind of happened because I grew up real shy. Just real shy. Now, I was a musician. I was a drummer in a band, and I didn't have any trouble getting up on stage and playing. But holding a conversation face to face with somebody, if I didn't know them, I was kind of uncomfortable and would be quiet. And I got a job in radio. I could sit behind a microphone and talk and DJ records and, you know, read the news, do the whole thing. But, talking to folks in person, just, it was another thing. Sitting behind a microphone, not so bad because I got a little more control. I can turn off the microphone if I want to. But doing it on video was a whole other thing. You know, I worked in television from, it was 80 through 85. And I never wanted to get in front of the camera. You know, I worked on the backside of it in engineering. And I did have a couple of appearances on there as an extra in a mobile home commercial or something like that, you know. No spoken parts, but, I didn't have any interest in doing that. And I guess, the thing about, that's happened with these podcasts and with ham radio for me is I'm talking with other folks and we're sharing a common interest in electronics, in communications, in radio. And I grew up in a small town where there was nobody I could talk to that knew about any of that. My family didn't, none of them were into any of this kind of geeky stuff. None of my friends in town, just the one guy. And, so I didn't have that much opportunity to talk with other like-minded folks. And here, they're out there. You know, these are the kind of people that I would have hung out with when I was growing up all the time, but there just weren't any around. And now they're out there. Some of them are new young kids that, are getting interested in this hobby. Some of them are people who've retired and finally took the time to get their ham radio license. And now they're getting on the air. They could have been heart surgeons or maybe, they worked for Texas Instruments or RCA or maybe they just worked at a convenience store, but they always like to tinker with electronics or radio hobbies. And there's a lot of other people out there that have got the same interests that you do, and you can learn a lot from them. So just you're going to have to feel comfortable. If you don't feel welcomed in a group, you're not really going to jump right in, especially if you're, real shy like I was. I finally got over the thing sitting in front of a camera just by doing it enough times. Public speaking, though, I'm still kind of scared of that. I've, done a few ham fests, forums and things like that. Now I'm a little more comfortable, but not really. But and I know maybe it looks like I'm engaging and, leading conversations and things. And I don't know. It just kind of happens or it just kind of develops as it goes along. I'm just kind of trying to steer a conversation. I'll tell you, as far as interviewing people and doing programs and things like that, you know, most of my time in broadcasting has been as an engineer. I wasn't on-air talent very long. But I used to work a lot at night, and one of our stations carried Larry King. And so I would hear Larry King a lot at night doing all these interviews with interesting people and authors and one thing or another. And I heard him say one night that he never read the book before the author got there. You know, he didn't have questions prepared or anything. And not that I'm a big Larry King fan, but I think he was successful at what he does. But what he said that kind of stuck with me is I just ask people questions that I want to know the answer to myself. And that's what I kind of try to do. And just turns out that most of the time, hey, you know, we all kind of wanted to know the answer to that question. So
One thing that I found works against a good interview is if you do read the book and you know too much about the person you're talking to, you miss the good questions because you already know that, and the audience will never know because you're not really probing the common area that they got the questions for. You know, they just, you know, you're pretty well there. You know it, so therefore you don't ask it. You know, so his point is well taken, and it's odd because I've always tried to say no, don't tell me anything about this guy because, you know, I want to go down this road the first time, just like the audience does. You know
that. Another thing, Ted, and I'll mention it, and you'll know exactly where I'm coming from, and anyone who's worked in broadcasting, and I think probably this plays in a little bit. I never really thought of it, but avoiding dead air, you know, because that's the first thing I learned in radio is that you never have dead air because it only takes a moment for somebody to tune right past your station and keep going. So you try to keep audio going all the time, and you know, I think that probably is just kind of something we learned from doing radio that kind of maybe, you know, fell over into the ham radio thing as well. I notice I say way too much because I'm, trying to hold the vox open or trying to avoid dead air. And I don't want to, as we would say, hog the frequency. I know your partner's sitting out there, and we haven't really given him a chance to say much of anything tonight.
Well, I do that on purpose because he embarrasses me.
I have lots of comments, but you know, I'm the same way though. You know, it's no pregnant pauses, please. However, I did want to jump in really quick. Let me jump in here real fast, and I wanted to give a shout out here real quick. Oh my goodness, where did he go? Now I don't even have him.
Now you're going to dead air now.
I know, it's dead air. Oh well, that's Jesse Quick. Yes, Jesse Quick. He's in Alabama, and he sent us a picture here of his rig showing us at an S8 down there in Alabama. And we had a couple of other people that posted in here as well. I'm just trying to find everybody. You caught me off guard. Usually what I do is I get everything ready to go, but yeah, so be it. And Pete, NS0D, sorry. WTW is pegging his scale on his meter there on his radio. Not sure where he's at, though.
You know, I just going to tell you, I've avoided television cameras and all that. I'm all right behind a mic, but, you know, George, I'm just too ugly for television. You know, I think there's some people God said, look, I don't want you on TV.
You know, look, so didn't stop me, Ted.
So anyways.
What is it that I say? I got a face for radio and a voice for print. I think that's how I put it.
Well, you know, some time ago, I went to work. I went to work at WSM, and I was on the air there. And I was working with this, we call them automation systems or playout systems, you may want to call it that, something along that line. And so anyways, it's the computer software that plays the music and the commercials and everything. You got a screen, you know, you don't have 45 RPM records, and we don't have cart machines anymore. We don't have CDs. Everything resides on hard drive in a computer. And I think that's everywhere, universal. There may be some stations out there that are still playing some things. I know here we've got a couple turntables. I play vinyl on the air off and on, and it's only because I can't find the song.
I do keep them away from the cart machine, though.
Yeah. Anyways, what I found was we were working with this software, and of course then I think they got rid of that software because it was old, and they put in, I think it was the next step was Scott Studios that replaced it. But anyways, what was in there worked fine, and it was called Pristine. Well, I don't know. I mean, we were sitting, I think it was in Huntsville. We were sitting, and all of a sudden George confessed. He said, well, I'm the guy behind Pristine. So evidently, you must have started that. Tell us about that company, because that was a very unique software package, because it played music off of a bank. I mean, a huge bank of CD players that was down the hallway. I mean, it was halfway across the building.
Massive.
Yeah.
I mean, this is a giant room.
18-disc compact disc changers were all wired up to this system. And, I mean, I never dreamed such a thing, you know. And I got to thinking about that. I thought, you know, that's a far more complex idea than what we're dealing with now when we're playing just strictly off a hard drive. But tell us, how did you ever in the world get into that? I mean, you were doing something called Cartworks, I think. I may have the name wrong.
Cartworks is a product that Tommy Martin and 5Z&O and myself and one other ham, Bob Leathers, N5RMZ, who let his license lapse. He moved away, and I don't know, he lost interest in the hobby, and he's no longer licensed. But
let me just say this, folks. You know, this was cutting edge technology, and if a radio station had this stuff, they were somebody. You know, if you were working around this stuff back then, because people were still on turntables and carts and stuff. But yeah, I don't want to interrupt you. Tell the story. I want to hear it.
Well, so Cartworks is the product that us three developed. Pristine was another company located out in California. But we started one called Cartworks. I had, one Christmas holiday, I bought a sound card for my PC. And this was, this is about the time Windows was coming along. And I flew with that sound card, and I got to noticing, you know, this thing sounds just about as good as these tape machines that we've been using. And I was spending half my life, you know, lining heads on carp machines, replacing capacitors in there, demagnetizing, you know, one thing or another. It just seems like half of my job was keeping all those tape machines going at the radio stations. And I saw this, store in the music or commercials at that point, because hard drives really weren't big enough to hold the music. But storing that on hard drive just seemed like the way to go. And I talked, you know, with my friends there, and they said, we can write that software. Let's do it and start a company. And I thought, well, yeah, I know we can write the software, but I don't know that we can start a company. But we did. And we started selling a product called Cartworks. And the on-screen interface looked like an old triple-decker cart machine, except we had six slots in it where you would load up six commercials or whatever, and you could fire them off and play them right off the hard drive. We were one of the first systems to use Windows, or we programmed the software to run under Windows. All the other ones that were out there at the time were DOS. So, we were early adopters of Windows there. And Pristine's products that you were talking about were DOS-based. They were one of the very first to make an automation system for radio. And the commercials were on hard drive on that system. The music was on CD players like you're talking about. They would have a bank of a number of, I think they were using Pioneer six-pack CD players. Maybe you'd load six CDs into a little package and plug it into the front of the CD player. And they had, you know, they just put a bunch of those in there, and that's where all the music was stored. And you would get your, you know, radio stations would buy their music recorded onto CDs so that, you know, it wouldn't be like you'd stick an Elton John album in there and there might be two songs you'd play and everything else was dead. I mean, you know, we were getting music services to where, you know, it was just all the hits or the songs that you wanted to play were on CDs and really no no excess on there. Everything was useful. Over in on Cartworks, we were only doing, we weren't really targeting music because the hard drives just weren't big enough, you know. So we were only doing spots. But Pristine was doing the CDs as well. And we wanted to get into that with Cartworks. So I actually went to the NAB show one year and went to the Pristine booth and met them and looked at what they were doing and kind of walked around behind the display there and peeked in to see how they were controlling those CD players. They had a little interface in there that they had gotten from, I think, Antex. They are a sound card manufacturer, had custom made this little box for them that they could hook to a serial port on the computer, and it would spit out the infrared codes for the remote controls of these CD players. And I don't remember if there was maybe a hardwire interface on the CD players. I don't think it did it with infrared. I think it actually connected into the player, but there were specific codes that this little box would handle. And so Pristine could just send the command from the computer to the little box, and then it would tell whichever CD player it was supposed to that it's time for you to play a song. Well, there's some drawbacks to that. As you know, with CD players, there's no feedback coming back. In other words, you could send a command to tell this player, play track number 3. But you would not know, you don't get a countdown back from the CD player that, you know, we're on track 3 and we've got 30 seconds left or anything like that. You just have to have in your database on the computer the length of that cut so that if it's a 3-minute song, then it's programmed in the database. The computer knows that this is 3 minutes. And at the end of that, I got to trip off the next one. Well, the drawback is if the CD player skips or the time in the database is entered wrong or anything like that, then you could go dead, you know, for 3 minutes or however long that cut was supposed to be before something else would come along. The other drawback to doing it that way is that, as I mentioned, you know, you're buying your CDs or CDs in libraries to where, you know, you've got multiple cuts and they're all usable on each disc. Certain songs could not be played back to back.
That's right. Because if they were on that same CD, you couldn't go from that cut to the next cut. If you had a disc and say Conway Twitty's "Hello Darlin'" was cut 3, and you wanted to go from that to a Stonewall Jackson cut, like anybody plays him anymore, but say that was cut 6. It was on the same CD. Actually, if it was in any of the discs in the same player, you could not play them back to back. So that's, it created a juggling that you had to do in order to. And the other thing about the Pristine system, which was strange, is you'd go into what is known, your playout system is in front of you and you're seeing as it plays. But then if for some reason you wanted to change something or you found a commercial that was in there that was outdated or something that you needed to do, you'd have to jump into the back screens in order to change anything. And the other thing is that once you jumped into those back screens, you had to get the work done and get out of there before the element that was playing ended. Because if you didn't, I don't know what happened. All I know is they said it was bad. It never happened to me because I always, I did it quick, got out of there, you know.
I can tell you what it was, and it's because it was DOS. It was not a multitasking operating system. So, you know, the computer had to be back where it was supposed to be so that it could do the next task it was supposed to. If you were off somewhere else, you know, it couldn't complete. Yeah, it's not like Windows where you could have a bunch of different things going on at once. You know, a DOS program pretty narrow in what it can do. So that's how I got in with Pristine. Is I had written, or me and my partners had written the first true graphically oriented Windows automation system for radio, and Pristine was one of the first companies to do it, but theirs was DOS based. And we got together one year at NAB. I mean, I had met those guys, and we started having some talks. They had a fair-sized customer base, bigger than we did because they'd been in it so long, but their product was aging because it was DOS-based, and they really needed something new. And I had a Windows product, and so we ended up merging those two companies together. So what Pristine sells these days and has sold for the last, I don't know, 13 or 14 years has been really my software. So it all grew up out of Cartworks, what Pristine has sold for, you know, the last decade or a little better. But that's been interesting stuff to work in. You know, I like radio, and I like computer programming, which I learned myself, and you know, in the evenings, just because, I mean, computer programming when I went to college was called Key Punch, so
yeah, the know, cards, you know,
right,
card readers, so, and yeah, I don't the first machine we were exposed to really was an Apple IIe.
Yeah,
that I brought home, and we played with it. And I think back on that, boy, that was really a limited, really limited. I remember the first hard drive I got was a 50 megabyte drive,
monster.
And I thought, all the never fill this up. You know,
so. My fondest memories of the computers was, I don't remember where we went to, but we packed up the computer, grabbed like two boxes of floppies. And we went to a LAN party.
You know,
So we're all hanging out amongst this giant table. You know, cables going everywhere, and everybody's swapping disks, and everybody's copying stuff. I mean, that was just, you know, I think I was the one carrying the monitor, and Dad was carrying the computer part of it. But I mean, it was fun. I mean, it was quite the eye opener to me. I mean, it was neat getting another Santa Claus game.
A genuine green Apple screen too.
Mm-hmm.
I was a Commodore 64 guy. That's where I jumped in.
Yeah, you guys were different, though. I mean, you had to go to an Apple group and hang out and copy disks. I mean, you know, that was what.
We did it too. Now we copied Commodore disk and later we copied PC disk, but. Yeah, that was a big thing, you know. Floppy disks were, that's where it was at, but then you had copy protection and one thing and another, and, you know, so you couldn't copy everything you wanted. But the floppy disk, the bulletin boards, CompuServe, all of that stuff, the kids these days are missing so much of the fun part of computing because they got the internet and iPhones and all of this. They missed the really hard stuff.
We used CompuServe, and we had a program that was called Producer. And we were all over Nashville using Producer. Now, what it did is it established a chat room, and you could send a still picture in audio clips. Because, you know, video, the network wouldn't handle it. So you had to send still pictures. So we were backstage at the CMA Awards. We were backstage during the Gospel Music Awards.
Yep.
We went to Memphis during the Handy Awards. And David and Matthew were right in the middle of all this. See, so, but it, it, you know, it radically changed. But then back then, nobody really understood what we were doing. It was like you almost had to be an avid CompuServe member, you know, and up on this stuff before you could understand. And this was before AOL came along, you know. And then, of course, AOL came along, and
then you got the busy signals.
Yeah. So, but I'm surprised even still today there's some folks using AOL for email.
Well, I was a beta tester for AOL. Back when I had the Commodore 64, there was a graphic operating system you could get for it that was called GEOS, made by Berkeley Softworks. And you used a mouse or a joystick, and you had icons and all of this kind of stuff. Nobody had this, you know. This was before the Macintosh, really. So those folks, I used it, and it was fun, but although it took, you know, like half an hour to boot up off a floppy disk, and you were constantly swapping disk when you wanted to do something. But Windows came along. Shortly after Windows started kind of, you know, making a go of it, these GEOS folks were a little late getting to that for the PC. So they decided they wanted to do an operating system, too, and I had kind of been in contact with them. So I was one of their beta testers, but they also made some kind of deal with AOL to do... where you could sign up and be a beta tester with them because they had AOL software on this GEOS operating system for the PC. So I signed up for that, and I had free online access to AOL. You know, I was paying big money to be on CompuServe, and all of a sudden I had this AOL that I could get on for free. And this was a multitasking environment. It wasn't like, you know, CompuServe, where you went in on a text screen and you could do one thing at a time. You could have multiple things going on you know, under AOL there. So that was big stuff then.
Well, I remember, but they were neck to neck. You know, it was CompuServe and AOL. You know, and we kind of leaned toward CompuServe. And I don't know. It seems like AOL approached us to do some content stuff, like what we were doing for...
I remember messing around with some of that. We did. We were providing our stories. There was stuff that was going on. Stories and press releases.
Yeah, and we did some pictures and some video. We did chats. We set up chats with country music artists here in Nashville. We'd set up a chat room, and they would hold a chat, you know, or whatever. That was a big deal, you know. Have Charlie Daniels in a chat room tonight, you know, and they liked that. I guess that drew people in, you know, to the service. But I was always kind of aggravated by the services because they were just notoriously slow about stuff, you know. And then the more people that would log in, the more it would bog down. It was like they just never really planned their bandwidth requirements or whatever to handle everybody. Of course, everything was in its infancy then. And then all of a sudden, AOL's, you know, they them and CompuServe both went to the web. And I thought, well, then what's the point? You know, you know, yeah. They're not on their own network. So what's the point of this? And, but that was a real interesting period of time, you know, and, I think now, when I see the marriage, what do you think about this? How do you feel about the marriage between, I call it the marriage between IT, internet, networking, and all that, and ham radio? I've got people. I'm telling you, I got one guy in particular that when I talk, I think Echolink is incredible. I just think Jonathan Taylor just went, you know, he's a genius. I mean, he came up with an idea that I think is just phenomenal, you know, and I like it better, really, than IRLP, because you can take your notebook somewhere and you can be in a hotel room, you know, and log into a repeater, you know, without having to search out a repeater in town and hope that their IRLP link is up, you know. But I really love Echolink, and yet I've got one fella here in our community here that will, you know, he then you know what he does? He says, I call it Echo Stink, you know, and he anything involving, you know, a computer, and I, you know, it's like we were talking about, you know, if you're on Echolink and you're in the middle of a group on a computer or on a repeater, I'll get this right here in a minute. And somebody calls you to the side to ask you a question, and you say, "Well, hang on a minute. Let's jump in a private room here." So you call direct and you talk back and forth with your private conversation. You've actually left the air, but you've also left the folks on the repeater free to carry on their conversations without you tying it up, especially if it's something that might be lengthy or something like that. But I love this stuff. But I hear so many guys talking down to it, and I want to know what do you think about the advent of the computer? Has it taken away from ham radio? You think it's in any way?
Well, I think in certain ways maybe it has, but that doesn't mean I'm against it. You know, I'm a big computer hobbyist, and as a matter of fact, I run an Echolink node here for one of the local repeaters. I've got a little thin client computer that sits over here in the rack, and I built an interface for it, and got an old Radio Shack 2-meter radio that I use here. That it's an Echolink node for a repeater just outside of town here, and I've run it for a number of years. I originally started playing with Echolink because my friend Tommy, who I mentioned, N5ZNO, one of the founding partners of Amateur Logic there, you know, we met each other years ago, back in the 90s, because of computers. I had put a message on a bulletin board. I was looking for other people who had used a quick basic programming language, and he's the only one who answered. And we just became friends and had what you're talking about, these floppy drive disk copying parties and all of that. And we've just been good friends all along. We both got licensed, you know, as hams about the same time. He moved from here to Missouri for a couple of years. When he moved up, I mean, we had talked, me and him and a couple other guys talked every day during drive time. Back and forth, you know, when everybody was driving to work, we were all close enough that we could talk simplex. And so we just, you know, had conversations every day. And when he moved, I set up an Echolink node here with my call sign on it. He set up one where he moved to in Missouri, and just on a handy talkie and a little short antenna, we linked them together and just left them linked, and put them both on a simplex frequency there. And whenever drive time came along, everybody just got on the radio, and it was like he had never moved, you know, because the radio I had here was linked up to the one he had there, and it just it expanded our footprint to where we could communicate just almost identical to if he was in town. Now, if the internet went down, sure. In an emergency, you know, like Hurricane Katrina or something, it may not be there. So I wouldn't say it'd be my only plan in an emergency communications link, but why throw it out? I mean, it works. It works good. You know, they've done a pretty good job of making sure that only licensed ham radio operators are on it and are going to, you know, end up getting on the air on a repeater or anything. So I'm all for that. I never really used IRLP. We never had a node here in town. A friend of mine bought the hardware, but one reason or another, he never could get it to work right. So we just never had one. Now we've got D-Star here and System Fusion and some of these newer ones. I'm not real big on those. I mean, I think they're fine. Tommy uses D-Star a fair amount. But the thing I kind of like about the Echo Link is the first one I used, it's very simple. You can build your own interfaces. You can run it on your iPhone or your Android device, just about anything. So anywhere you go, if you want to get on ham radio and you got your phone with you, you can get on ham radio.
Well, I know I sat at the kitchen table when I first put Echo Link on my Android, and I just started, you know, poking around looking for a repeater somewhere, and I logged into this repeater and said, threw out my call sign, and where I had landed, I had no idea where I even was, but I was talking to a ham going down the road on a repeater, and he was on the Isle of Man. And I said, I thought, you know, here I am sitting at the kitchen table, but I'm talking over a repeater. You know, I don't know how far away that would be. And we had a full-scale conversation, and it went really well. And I thought, you know, after that, I mean, I'd worked Echo Link on my notebook before, and I always thought it was cool because if you're out traveling and you're on the road or something, you can check into your local repeater, providing they've got enough sense to put Echo Link on it. And I've had several discussions here with folks that run the repeaters here in Nashville, and the things will be dead. Be no conversations on them at all. I said, why don't you put Echo Link on? Oh, no. It's, you know, and they go into this whole thing. You know, it's like, I don't get it. Don't get it. Don't get it. If I were in charge of a repeater, or I had a repeater, or I had the ability to put one on here in this area, I would definitely make sure Echo Link was included. You know, to me, that's just, you know, that's your insurance policy that there's going to be somebody on there. You know, I mean, you don't want the thing to go dead, you know. And it's a lot more interesting. Can you imagine? And on your machine, I'm sure you have this where, you know, you're driving around in your car and all of a sudden somebody checks in from Timbuktu, you know, and you have a chance to talk to somebody on the other side of the world or the other side of the country on your machine that wouldn't be there, you know, if you didn't have Echo Link installed and working. So I think it's cool. You said you think that maybe computers have taken away from ham radio some. I don't see that. I think it's the other way around. I think that there are people in it now because of the fact that we have a combination of IT and ham radio. We have a synergy there. And I think that's served to draw people in. You know, I don't know. So you and I are going to, you know, we'll have to get together privately and fight this out, okay?
Yeah, well, I can tell you why I said that. And I'm not against IT and ham radio being tied together. And, yeah, I think there's a tremendous crossover between those groups. But the only reason I said that is just based, and it probably shouldn't be the Internet. I should be blaming cell phones, shouldn't I? I think that's where the two-meter traffic went, isn't it?
I don't know. I mean, it's different, though. I mean, even with young kids that I've talked to that's been exposed to amateur radio, especially young ones, you know, and they come in and they see, like, for example, they see a CW demonstration, you know, and they just get raptured by it. You know, it's like, God, I want to do that. You know, it's like there's some intrigue behind the secrecy, you know, of Morse code, you know, being able to talk to somebody with a telegraph key, you know. And it grabs them. You know, I think that the cell phone just doesn't have any of that. The cell phone, you pick up your cell phone and you call Japan. So what? I mean, it's like there's, you know, and most people won't even bother to call. They're going to text. So you text a guy in Japan. No big deal. I mean, it's like, it's very routine. But if there's, excuse me, I've had a horrible thing going on here, upper respiratory, and I've been fighting it all night. But, you know, if you've got a guy's voice coming at you over a speaker and you're talking over radio, you know, even if only one side is on the air and the other side is connected to the Internet, see, there's something magical about that. It's like bubble lights on a Christmas tree, you know? It's just, the regular lights, you know? But now bubble lights, that's a different deal, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, we had the bubble lights when I was a kid, and I think they belong to my grandparents. But yeah, animation, man.
And I feel, you know, I think that's what it is. It's that magical quality, the magical radio quality. Now, I started off in Citizens Band. You know, there was a guy that lived just a block away from me that had a five-element Long John beam that was bigger than his house. And as he would turn that thing, it would stick out 2-3 feet, either, you know, front, back, or side to side. It was bigger than his house. And I walked over there because I didn't know the difference between Citizens Band and ham radio. And I went in his house, and there's a radio sitting there and all these voices coming out of it and everything. And he'd get on and talk, and the people would talk back to him, and, you know, and all that. So I don't know. I think there's a magic in radio, and I don't care. You know, it's like when we talk about people, newbies getting on. If people come, and I don't think we have as many now coming from the CB ranks. We used to have people coming from CB ranks in. I don't think we have as many of those folks anymore. But when they would come in, I know that a lot of the curmudgeons would just break out in hives if they used any CB lingo, you know, over the air. And I used to tell those guys, you know, you ought to learn some of this CB lingo, you know. Some of it's pretty cool. You know, you sound pretty dated with your high when you're talking, you know.
Yeah.
Why don't you get rid of the high and give me a 10-4, good buddy. It's a lot more friendly sounding high. So anyways, but I think the, you know, the only thing I'm wondering, you know, these apps that are on the cell phone now, there's some of them that have radio walkie-talkie type apps on there, you know, and you can. Well, I turned you down because you left the room. Go ahead.
I'm sorry. Yes, you turned me down. Oh, how uncourteous. No, there is. There's a bunch of those apps. I've played around with a few of them. There's plenty of police scanners. There's fire ambulance. There's actually, I ran across a couple of them where you can listen to a few of the two meter stuff, 440. And there was a guy that actually had an HF rig, too, that you could just, he parked it on a frequency, and you just sit there and you could listen to it via your cellular device, using up all of your bandwidth while you're driving down the road.
Yeah, I went through the CB thing too now, and that was fun. All my few friends that I had that were hams were trying to get me to go into ham radio, but by then, you know, I was working at the radio station and playing in a band and chasing girls, and I just didn't really have time to study for a ham exam at that point in my life. But when I got out of college, I went to work at a electronics and stereo and CB store. So at that, I got over CB pretty quick after I went to work at that store.
I don't know that you ever really totally get over it. See, I just went to a ham fest and I walked out of the place with a Browning Golden Eagle.
Oh, wow.
You know, it's like, and it was really cheap. I mean, I looked at that and I said, how can I turn this down? There's nobody to talk to, but, you know, it's fun just having it sit there. You know, I mean, just, you know, what, turning it on, letting it light up and pushing the button on the banana mic and listening to it ping, you know. Not a soul to talk to, though. I mean, I've been all over. There's nobody on there. You know, I thought, oh, well, this is worse than 2 meters. But I think it would be fun if the FCC would allow us hams to use our call signs on Citizens Band, because I think that would make a great farming community to entice people into the hobby.
Well, I don't think they would say anything to you if you used your call sign over there, would they? I mean, there's no law against it. But
well, if you can get on 80 meters and talk the way some of these guys do, I don't see how they'd have any axe to grind if you use your call sign.
Yeah, but,
you
know, and
go ahead.
That's one thing I wanted to comment on. You said, you know, all these guys on ham radio, or, you know, you get somebody comes on and they slip a 10-4 in or something accidentally. And, you know, they get run over by the Gestapo. Well, you know, awful lot of those guys came from CB too. They won't admit it, but
oh no,
you know, that's where they came from. And there's nothing wrong with CB operators joining up and getting licensed and getting on ham radio. I think there's an awful lot of hams out there with some CB in their background there. And that's perfect, you know. I mean, if you like radio, well, you know, it's the next step.
Well, I'll tell you, I've got a little cure for the curmudgeons, if you want to send the curmudgeons on a rampage. Now, you know, I've been told that when you go on the air, especially, say, for example, on any frequency, you have exactly 9 minutes and something seconds, maybe 9:59 or something, before you actually legally are obliged to ID, which is different than it was years ago, because years ago you had to sign on immediately, and when you signed out, you had to cross-sign with whoever else you were talking to. So if I were talking to you and I signed out, I'd have to say W5JDX, this is WB8PUM. And that would be the way you'd had to do it. But I understand all that's changed now. I don't know, because I don't sit and read the rules. But what you do is you see, George, you get on and you start a conversation with somebody. And you talk, and you see you get maybe 5 minutes into the conversation, right in the heat of a real interesting conversation. And then I would turn to you and I would say, George, could you tell me something here? How hard is it to pass the test to get the license for one of these radios? And I'll tell you what. Now, there's some of the folks out there will start laughing. They get it immediately, okay? But see, you got to understand the curmudgeons have a completely different mentality about them. They immediately go into the lockdown police mode, okay? The red flashing light is on. They've got the trunk open. They've got their yellow hoodie on with their flares in their hands, and they're ready to go, okay? They're ready to rumble. But anyways, just if you ever want to be amused, that's something you can try. That's what I call my anti-curmudgeon maneuver.
I can see that as being effective. You know, that you mentioned at the first of the program here tonight, Ham College, hamcollege.tv is one of the other shows that I do where we're trying to make new hams and helping them prepare to take their technician's exam. We went over that subject of ID and recently, and you are correct. When you start a conversation, start talking, you don't legally have to ID right then. You don't have to ID till 10 minutes is up, and then you've got an ID at the end of your conversation, but you don't have to ID when you begin, and I didn't know that. And we discovered that myself.
I think it's a good idea.
Oh yeah,
a good excellent. Idea to ID immediately, only because it's like self promotion. You want the other person to get familiar with your call sign. You know, it's something.
Well,
else.
It's good practice. It's good practice. Yeah.
And I can't remember who I heard say this. It was somebody, I believe, from the commission that said that when a person does a phonetic ID, you know, if I come on with Whiskey Bravo 8 Papa Uniform Mike. The commission does not consider that a legal identification. So you've got to do your call sign, WB8PUM, and then that's your call sign. If you do the phonetics, that's a bonus. But they don't really consider the phonetics, you know, if you go on and just give the phonetics, you know, like a legal ID. But, you know, I don't know. There's all these little things you run into later, you know. But I don't know whether the commission closing down a lot of their monitoring stations and stuff like that. I don't guess we won't be learning as much about that, because it used to be those guys at Allegan, Michigan and Powder Springs. They'd send you a little note to remind you where you had screwed something up, you know, and they'd set you straight. And now I guess we're going to be missing a whole lot of that, because they're shutting those places down, which I think is kind of tragic. I think communications is very important, and I think having monitoring stations to ensure the safety of our public communications and police communications and aircraft communications and all these things that are critical. You know, to me, it seems like we need our monitoring stations to make sure everything's okay. But who knows, you know.
I think we've got some of our priorities mixed up and up at that level. They're shutting down field offices too. So I don't understand. I don't see where anything's gotten good enough that we don't need policing there anymore.
No, no, not at all. And it's just a good insurance policy. Tell us now. Tell us now. Tell everybody that's listening. We know Ham Nation is on Wednesday evenings, 8 p.m. Central. And you can see George on every episode of Ham Nation. As you tell a little bit about that segment that you do, and then also talk to us about Ham College and all, anything else you've got that I'm, you know, either gotten lost on or unaware of.
Okay. Well, Ham Nation, and of course, that's simulcast here on WTWW every Wednesday night at 8 Central. You can watch it live at live.twit. That's TWIT.TV. That's the show with Bob Heil, Gordon West, Don Wilbanks, and myself. I do a segment on there called Smoke and Solder, where I'm not doing it every week now, where I have a new video there of something I've built or some technique I've shown or some discussion or something. But I have something there, whether it's something I produced or something that someone else produced, that I've gotten permission to run it. You know, we've got some technical snippet there for about 10 minutes on every Ham Nation episode. I've done a lot of things there, built soft rock receivers or transmitters, talked about antennas, talked about capacitive reactants, just about everything under the sun. It's very similar to the stuff that we do on my original program, Amateur Logic. You can find it at amateurlogic.tv. We don't put those out every week. They only come out once a month, and it's around the 15th of each month. We've just celebrated 11 years there. We do probably more technical-type segments on Amateur Logic because we've got three main host and a fourth one now that's joined us in the past year. It's myself, Tommy Martin, N5ZNO, our friend Peter Barrett, who's in Australia, VK3PB, and then Emil Diodine, KE5QKR, that's down in Slidell. We do a show around the 15th of every month. We stream that live, too. Generally, we've got Facebook group, Google Plus group, where we'll post in advance of when we'll be streaming it live, but most of our viewers there are getting the download and watching it later. But, we've grown a tremendous community there. And, you know, the internet, Ted, we've met a ham, Peter, you know, from Melbourne, Australia, has become part of that program that's in our third year. He joined us, so we wouldn't have been able to do that had it not been for the internet. So anyway, we're fortunate there. ICOM and MFJ sponsor us, and it's helped us to continue the program and continue to grow it. We typically, I'd say Ham Nation or Amateur Logic, either one gets probably somewhere in the neighborhood of 50,000 views per episode. And you think about ham radio content, that's a lot of eyeballs, and they're not all hams. You know, we're exposing a lot wider variety of folks out there to ham radio and just making a lot of new hams. We're getting them interested, and, we'll help them get licensed, but once they get here, you know, the ham radio community has got to welcome them on in and kind of show them the ropes, elbow them.
You know, well, the Ham College, the Ham College podcasts are primarily targeted toward different subject material. But see, I guess what I say with a video there, you know, you're involved in teaching something each and every week on that thing.
Yeah, and right now we're we're studying for the technician exam, and we'll go over a number of the questions on the technician pool every episode. And the Ham College episodes are released at the end of each month. And we go over every question in the pool, and then we talk about the answer for it and why that's the right answer. But we also talk about the wrong answers and why they are the wrong answer. We give some theory and some background on the different subjects. So it's more than just, study the question, study the answer. We're trying to give a full, in-depth view of it, the subject. So you'll know more than just the right answer to the question.
But now, the Ham College is only once a month then?
That's once a month. That's at the end of every month we release an episode.
See how easily I get confused. I said every week.
No. Well, I might say that sometimes too, but if I do, I'm just confused as well. But Amateur Logic on the 15th of every month, hamcollege.tv at the end of every month. But we'll be going to the general question pool here before long. We're getting near the end of the technician pool.
Well, that's cool because now, you can illustrate on video some of these things that's really hard to get. If a person's listening to the audio, so it's like I tell people, there's something suitable for radio when, like I remember the old commercial where they dropped the maraschino cherry out of the airplane into a 5,000 million pound thing of whipped cream that's spread all over Lake Michigan, And then somebody said, try to do that on TV. Well, now they got CGI, so I guess they can now. They can make it look like it, But then there's other things over radio. It's like try to tell someone over radio how to tie a shoe. Okay? I mean, something so simple as that. It just can't be done. So it's, that's where I think the video is a perfect marriage there for especially amateur radio instructions. Listen, we are out of time. As they say, we have talked both hind legs off the mule. And I've really enjoyed this. What do you think about this guy, David?
This is awesome. He's into everything.
Just the fun stuff, But hey, I'm having a good time doing it. I'm sharing it with others out there who I know enjoy the same thing. And we're just having fun, That's what it's all about, and we're learning a little something in the process.
Well, I think one of the purposes of what we do is to allow the listener who watches you do a produced podcast actually to hear your voice and get to know you a little bit better, to know all about you and who you are. And I think that makes it really cool because as folks come away from QSO, they feel like, hey, I know that guy. I'd like to be friends with him because they get to know you. And we've got the time to do that on this show, and that's what we do. So, but I thank you much for joining us. This is it. We've really kind of overstayed our welcome, a little overtime, but that's okay. We can make that up in production, as you know. Go ahead.
Yeah, thanks for having me here tonight, Ted. And we really all appreciate what you guys do with QSO Radio Show. It's been a long time favorite, and it's another way to spread ham radio as well. And we need more good content on shortwave, and I really like what you're doing there at WTWW, not with just this show, but now you're carrying Ham Nation. You've got Bob Hiles.
Theater Organ.
I'm trying to think of the name.
Yeah, Theater Organ from the Ozarks, somewhere. Yeah.
That's it, yeah. You got that. You've got the music that you play on here. Shortwave's been sorely lacking this kind of entertainment for a number of years now, and I'm really glad to see you guys kind of bringing it back because people have got the radios out there. Let's give them a little variety, and what they can listen to.
Well, thank you so much, George 73. Yeah. You have a good evening, and thank you for joining us. You'll have to come back because we'll never run out of stuff to talk about, that's for sure.
73, guys.
If you enjoy listening to shortwave at home, you'll enjoy it even more in the car. You can get away from the dull, boring AM/FM stations and listen to something really cool on shortwave in your car with Car Shortwave Radio. Their website is carshortwaveradio.com. A small, inconspicuous antenna mounts either on your trunk or on your hood, plugs into the cigarette lighter, comes in on your car radio, and you can read the frequency out on your car radio dial. You control it all with a little key fob. It's slick. It makes your car radio sound like a Wurlitzer jukebox when you're listening to WTWW. Go to carshortwaveradio.com. That's carshortwaveradio.com. Once again, go to carshortwaveradio.com, and you'll be glad that you did.